Hello, welcome to episode 11 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that man and my name is Graham Lee. This time I wanted to talk about an essay. I kind of built this list of interesting and important essays from the history of software engineering that I thought I'd do occasional episodes on. Actually, it's sort of scope creep, which is ironic given the topic of the episode. It was going to be an essay called No Silver Bullet by Fred Brooks, who's also the author of The Mythical Man Month. And so the fact that I have managed to like blow past the original scope and I'm now going to do an episode on the writings of Fred Brooks is entirely coincidental, incredibly ironic, more so than like rain on your wedding day or anything like that, but definitely shows some of what he was talking about. Fred Brooks was a project manager and developer manager for IBM and managed the IBM project for System 360 and the design phase of the software engineering for the operating system OS 360, which was a very large project. The System 360 was the first sort of family of compatible computers. Now, apart from like a very restricted low-end machine, all of the other machines could all run the same software, and so the operating environment and the compilers and so on were designed to run across all of them. The project was huge, probably like 1,000 person years of effort, and definitely overran, definitely blew past its original budget. And so a lot of his reflections on the way to run a software project come from what he perceived of as the failures of the System 360 project and of IBM to control its resources. Now, he doesn't call the project a failure. Indeed, it was a success. It was a very successful line of business for IBM. But definitely the project didn't go according to plan. He's also written a lot about design. He's got a very good book called The Design of Design, where he reflects on design as a sort of process and on design as a human to human mediation of interaction, and uses examples from software as well as from like architecture. He designed his own summer house and talks about design in that context as well as in the sort of product or software context. So the article I wanted to talk about was No Silver Bullet, which is fairly late in Fred Brooks's career, because he had already been writing for a long time before that. So I kind of got there through rereading bits of The Mythical Man Month. And The Mythical Man Month really kind of, it's almost an archetype of why I wanted to do these posts, this series on the famous writings in software engineering, because they typically are famous because of some glib phrase or aphorism that has come to be identified with the overall document. So we have the example of the Edgar Dijkstra article, Go-To Statement Considered Harmful, where people know about that that phrase, the considered harmful phrase, which wasn't even by Dykstra. That was a phrase used as the title for the letter when it was published by the editor of the journal, Niklaus Fiat. Or people know of the phrase premature optimization is the root of all evil, and they know that it's by Donald Knuth, and don't even know that it is from a rebuttal to the original paper called Structured Programming with Go-To Statements, and don't know the rest of the context of that article. And so it was taking these kind of nuggets, these aphorisms, these truisms from software engineering, and then looking at the articles in which they were written that kind of excited me to do this project. And the Mythical Man Month has very much that kind of aphorism at its heart. If you ask people about the Mythical Man Month now, it was a book written in the middle of the 1970s, they will quote, or often misquote, Brooks's Law, which is the phrase, adding manpower to a late software project makes it later. Now, Fred Brooks was writing in the 1970s and I think wasn't merely using men and manpower as as the sort of gender neutral he that people have argued for in historical usage of English. I think he genuinely came from a world in which all of programming and all of engineering was expected to be done by men. I don't think he even meant person power then. I think IBM was the company that introduced the programmer's aptitude test, which looked for that sort of introverted male personality type and made the assumption that people who had that personality type would be good at programming. And so they very much were at the forefront of enclosing programming as an accessible career path to a lot of people. I'm not going to apologise for that. I'm also not going to correct Fred Brooks's use of the gender-specific words like manpower. I'm going to present them within that context of this point in history. But the phrase, the Brooks Law phrase, adding manpower to a late software project makes it later, is acknowledged by Brooks himself to be an oversimplification of the argument made in what is chapter 2 of The Mythical Man Month, and is actually a very, very short, few-page essay, in which he has a 5-point argument. And he lists these points in the first page of the essay, and I'd like to quote the first one verbatim. First, our techniques of estimating are poorly developed. More seriously, they reflect an unvoiced assumption which is quite untrue, i.e., that all will go well. And I think that's still true today. You know, what we tend to do now with frameworks like Scrum and what are called the agile methodologies is we tend to break off bits of our project at a time. But I think there's still that kind of lack of contingency in estimation. I definitely am guilty of that and feel it. You know, I'm asked how long a piece of work will take, and even if I'm working on some sort of small task that should likely take a few hours or a couple of days, I still think about that happy path. If I don't get it wrong, if all of the stars align, and if what I want to do fits well into the design of the existing project, then it will take a few hours or a couple of days. And that really is endemic. For some reason, despite the fact that I've been working on programming projects for a good couple of decades now, I still don't go, well, it looks like if all the stars align, it should take 2 days, and it could probably take a couple of weeks if everything goes wrong, or it will take 2 days and then I'll get it back with a bunch of bugs from QA and then I have to think of something else. And then like there's another 2 days from there, or whatever is a more realistic path through the through the project. His second point is that it is the cost of a project that can be measured in man months. The progress cannot. What you want to measure for progress is how much have you got done? What is complete? What can you sell to the customer? What will the customer get out of it? And no customer wants to buy a few person months of work. What they want to buy is a great music player or a life organizer or a communication tool or a fun game. You know, there's this kind of Marxist view of economics that the value of a product is the crystallized labor power that went into it, that the reason that things cost more than produced goods cost more than the ingredients that went into them is because time went into them as well, and that time was spent by a worker on things that could have just been producing all that they needed to eat, to live in general, but actually produce that and some surplus that went into the value of this product. But when we're buying a product, we're not thinking about how many crystallized labor hours are in this. Is it worth to me the exploitation of the employees who created it? We're thinking, what is the value to me? What do I get out of owning this? And would I rather own this than the other commodities that I have at my disposal? So we shouldn't be thinking about production of software in terms of time. We should be thinking about production of software in terms of valuable outputs that people will want to make use of. And this is still a project problem, I think, today with the way that a lot of software companies track their progress. If you're in an organization that tracks velocity, what you've done with velocity is abstracted away the direct measure of time in terms of story points, but you've still asked people to estimate stories based on how many points they think go into it. What's the bigness of a story? And then you've got velocity, which is what's your completion of points per unit time. So you're still tracking your progress on a project in terms of some rate of consumption of labor power, not amount of value that goes into the project. Now, hopefully you're prioritizing in terms of value, but often that isn't the case. And people look at the sprint and they look at what capacity they've got and they decide to take in the stories that they think they can win in that sprint, rather than starting on a thing that may take 2 or 3 sprints to complete, but that is the most impactful or valuable thing that they could give to their customers, or that they could use to acquire new customers. So far we're 2 for 2. Our techniques of estimating are as bad now as they were in the mid 70s, and our measure of progress in terms of person time has not improved either. And I'm going to also suggest that his third point hasn't changed much. He uses this example of a French chef who says cooking good food takes time. If you're still waiting for your food, it's not a problem. It means that you've got some very good food coming. And he says that programmers and programmers' managers should be able to push back to their organization on like, you know, unrealistic end dates. Like, we're going to this conference in 3 months, we're going to show all of these features, and the whole thing is going to be ready to demonstrate in those 3 months. I think that a lot of places that I've seen, a lot of software organizations I've been in, or people I've talked to from other organizations, still have this problem that the priorities and the deadlines are both set from outside, and that there's this kind of tension within an organization that there's the technology team, and then there's this kind of other group called the business, capital T, capital B, who are like the people who interface with the customers, the people who make unrealistic schedule expectations, unrealistic marketing claims, sell products that don't exist. This is all the business's problem, not the engineering's problem. Engineering's problem is to put out the fires that are started by the business. And you know, that lack of integration, that idea that there are sort of two different organizations pulling in different directions with conflicting interests, is not healthy. It's not a good sign of a well constructed organization, and it leads to this idea of feature factories, which is a modern article from a few years ago that I'm going to put into the show notes, which is the idea that the engineering team exists to take requirements in, even if they're like woolly defined requirements like user stories, in one end, and to sort of excrete features out of the other end. So they're not part of the decision-making process, and they're not part of the design and construction of the software. They're just this sort of, you know, machine that the rest of the organization can exploit in order to produce software. Brooks's fourth point is that schedule progress is poorly monitored. Now, I think that this is the thing that agile techniques, and particularly agile project management techniques, which I think are slightly different from like agile software development, these have been addressed rather well. You know, we now have very frequent course corrections. We have short iterations. We have regular feedback on progress and so on. So we have managed to track what we're doing. I remember my first job as a as a developer with software engineer in my job title. I'd written software for employers before that, but you know, this was my first job where I was actually a full-time programmer. And we started on a project which, you know, in order to sort of make me feel better about it, my manager gave the project a code name, which was the model of motorcycle that I rode. And you know, it was supposed to be a small project where we ported an existing Mac application from PowerPlant, which was a third-party application framework for classic macOS, to Cocoa, which was the native framework on macOS 10. Now, we estimated 3 months for the project. It actually took about 2 years. This goes back to this first point about the unvoiced assumption that all will go well. But we had project like milestones or gates, and we reviewed progress whenever we got to one of these gates. So if it took, you know, 3 months to write the specification, when we were expecting to spend 3 months on the entire project, then that meant that the first time we would ask, are we on track, would be on the due date, because that would be when the specification review was. That's not how software works anymore. We definitely have, whether or not we're very good at reprioritizing or replanning, or at, you know, pulling the plug on bad projects, regardless of whether we do those things well, we're typically on a 1 to 2 week basis going, where are we on this project? How far have we got? What how much do we think we've still got to do? And now his fifth point is the one that a lot of the essay is about and the one that gives rise to Brooks's law. Adding people to a late project is like trying to douse a fire with gasoline. You'll need more, you'll have more fire, and so you'll need to douse it more, and so you'll apply more gasoline, and then you'll have even more fire. Why is this? Well, everyone you bring onto the project comes with like training requirements and onboarding costs, and they're going to take away from the productivity of the people who are already on the team while they are being trained and being brought up to speed. And then the ongoing communication costs are going to be greater because there's now more overhead in making sure that everybody understands the project. I don't know whether this has ever been fixed. There's a graph, very sort of woolly, unscientific, like here's a curve, I'm going to say it's true graph in Mythical Man Month, where Brooks says that you can imagine that there is a minimum sort of number of people time point in space, and that's probably the one that you started with. And if you remove people from that, your project will take longer because you'll have fewer people to do the effort you planned for. And if you add people, then your project will take longer because you have more effort in order to support the more people. And so neither of those things is any better. It kind of feels a bit like, a bit made up, like a sort of Laffer curve or Kuznets curve from economics. I should make a note to add those to the show notes. I bet I don't. His point is that you probably can't do better and definitely won't do any better by adding people to a project. I don't know whether this has ever been fixed, since the Mythical Man Month times. I think every business I've seen has, when times are good, decided that what they need to do is to grow the team and hire the best people around, which happen to be whoever will accept average market rates in the local talent pool around the office. But you definitely rarely hear of a successful company saying, we're going great guns with 12 engineers on the team, we're going to get rid of three of them and have a super duper awesome team of 9 people. And you often hear of companies that are hiring and hiring and hiring. You look at the Silicon Valley giants, the reason they're giants is because they hire so many people. They need these like village sized or even town sized campuses to hold them all. Now, I'm already the length of time that I normally put into an episode in, and I've got to the bit in the Mythical Man Month that I wanted to talk about the most, which is actually the third essay. So the first one is like 4 pages long, it's called The Tar Pit, and it's about how big projects grind to a halt. The second one is Mythical Man Month, which is how you can't fix those projects by adding more people. You can't just like throw extra bodies into the tar and hope that everybody comes out. The third one does suggest a way out. It's called The Surgical Team, and it's about a particular small team organisation, and we'll see, it's very, sort of 1970s in its design. But this is the suggestion that he makes without experience, it has to be said, on how he would prefer to run a software team that he thinks would get a decent sized project done with good sort of rate of progress. Actually, his idea is that this team can be scaled out by having multiples of that team. So if you've got a big project, then you have multiple surgical teams. It's based on an idea, well, it's based on two ideas, one of which directly is a thing called Chief Programmer Team from Harlan Mills. And this was a team that's organized around a central chief programmer who basically has all of the responsibility for getting the software delivered and correct, and also all of the authority to make all of the decisions. about how the team works and what they work on and how their thing is designed. The second idea that it is based on is one of the most controversial ideas in software engineering, which is the 10x programmer idea. Now, how you even get from the study that's quoted to the number 10 is not clear. So the study was done in 1968, in a time when there were two types of programming, online and offline programming. And that basically meant online programming, the programmer was actually sat at the computer and could interact with the program that was running. And they may have like a fancy pants debugger or at least a monitor that allows them to view the values in the memory and alter them while they're using a computer. And in offline programming, like, they didn't even have access to the computer. They would write out the code on paper or on some kind of forms that would then be handed to someone else who would either type a listing in get it recorded on punch cards or like entered into the computer somehow, and then it would go and be submitted to a batch queue, and then they would get the results back as a line printout and they could inspect the printout. So what we draw from this idea of like offline programming and even from 1968 vintage online programming probably doesn't tell us much about the way that programming is done now. Nonetheless, what this study found was that individual performance on various programming tasks varied by a wild range of factors. These variances were like much larger than some of the variances across different contexts. So what they were trying to do was to demonstrate that online programming was more efficient than offline programming, and indeed it was. But the massive discrepancy in individual performance was much greater than the effect size of the online versus offline situation. But these different problems weren't necessarily relevant, reflective or representative of what real programmers were really doing when they're really working. So, the biggest discrepancy was between someone debugging a particular program, which is called algebra. The fastest person did it 28 times faster than the slowest person. Which basically takes it from like hours to weeks in terms of total effort. But what that doesn't tell us is whether that person was good at debugging, or whether the bug that they were faced with was one that was easy to fix, or why they managed to do it so quickly. That study says. So I'll put a link in the show notes, but there's a quote. The representativeness of these problems for programming tasks is unknown. So we know that there's a large range of metrics that we can gather when people do a thing with a computer. But we don't know whether that means that some programmers are 10 times better than others. In fact, we don't even know whether the same people who are good at, say, the debugging task are the best at or the worst at some of the other tasks. We know that the debugging was, there's a factor of 28 time difference. We know that the smallest of the algebra programs was 1/6 of the size of the largest, that the fastest ran in 20% of the wall clock time of the slowest, and the most efficient used 1/8 of the processor time of the least efficient. But we don't know whether that was one person who wrote and debugged their code much faster than everybody else and that code was better, or whether the person who was slowest to debug had the most efficient program, or how those things were distributed. So to go from that, both the wide range of numbers and the wide range of tasks and the fact that the tasks aren't representative necessarily of programming, and the problems with the knowing who was responsible for which of the tasks, going from that collection of facts to saying some programmers are just 10 times better than other programmers doesn't ring true. There's a great analysis of this in a chapter of a book called The Leprechauns of Software Engineering. I'm going to put a link to that in the notes. It's a great book, very snappy read, very fun to read, and goes into more examples of this kind of idea in software engineering. So, Brooks has got this idea that a small, sharp team of skilled programmers, whether they are 10x programmers or not, is easier to manage than a larger team. And he believes that they would be better to work with, but that they would only be able to produce small-scale software systems. Yeah, we see that today. If you look at what you could do with, say, a team of 10 engineers, you might think about building a product website, a software as a service application with very simple feature set, something like selling financial services online or physical products. You probably wouldn't build a complex software system with that team. If you look at even just bigger websites like YouTube or Netflix have hundreds of engineers working on them, operating systems, hundreds, maybe thousands. But his point, as I said earlier, is that you can take a small-scale team that can build a sort of decent-sized thing in like a couple of years, and that's even reasonable for these like product websites. Okay, yes, we can get the MVP out much quicker than that, a matter of weeks. But to actually get something that's competitive in the marketplace, we do tend to spend a year or two iterating on that initial idea. If we take that and we build our whole system out of these small sharp teams, each completely owning a part of it and communicating as necessary with the other teams at the interfaces, that, he suggests, is a better approach than just scaling up an engineering team to the hundreds of people that you would otherwise need. And of course, when you look at a large project, you do find that there are usually feature teams or component teams who are responsible for particular parts of it. Although often there'll be some sort of meta level architects or principal engineers or something who will do some direction across the entire of the effort. So who's on this team? And this is definitely Brooks's version rather than Harlan Mills's version. He uses analogies from a surgical team. So we have the surgeon being the chief programmer, the person who is ultimately responsible for all of the design of the solution and the code and the testing. They are fully responsible for it, and they do a bulk of the work. Then there's a sort of co-pilot role, which is a bit like, I think the best analogy I could come up with is the relationship between Picard and Riker in Star Trek The Next Generation, between the captain and the number one. The number one's role is always to criticise the decisions that are made by the surgeon, by the chief programmer, to suggest alternatives, to explore and present other alternatives and arguments in favour of them, but also ultimately to accept the decisions made by the surgeon and to implement the plans and the ideas that they come up with. So they've got a responsibility for making sure that those ideas are well annealed and tempered by being compared with alternatives, by making sure that the decision that's been taken is the best one. Then you have an administrator who looks after all of the sort of mechanics of interfacing the team with the business. It should be up to the surgeon who they hire for their team, but they shouldn't have to do all of the HR stuff and the interviewing and the payroll and whatnot themselves. Most teams that I've been on don't actually have a dedicated administrator. Some of them do. Sometimes the project manager takes the role of like escalating that stuff, and it kind of leaves the team and just becomes this amorphous, as we were saying about the business, it becomes a sort of somebody else's problem, and there's nobody on the team who has the responsibility or the authority for making those kinds of decisions or actions. The surgeon is responsible for documenting the code, but there's an editor who is there to ensure the quality of the documentation. Brooks then has two secretaries because it's the 1970s, and even though programmers type on keyboards by this point all the time, using a typewriter is still beneath them. There's a program clerk. If we update this idea to like a modern team, we'd probably say that they're in charge of version control and CI. They're basically the sort of workflow people and the artifacts people. They make sure that the whole team has visibility on the latest test results, on historical test runs, on the documentation, and on like program artifacts like the source code and the produced binaries. So they're kind of doing some build system work, some ops, some version control, some release management maybe. There's a toolsmith who basically kind of curates the tools, utilities, libraries, programming environments used by the team. And I've worked on teams, particularly in the JavaScript world, where this would be a really important task to give to somebody, to actually give someone responsibility for. There's a whole lot of different libraries in the JavaScript world, and some of them work well because they sort of follow particular designs that are also followed by other libraries. Some of them don't work well together because they've taken their hints from different places. Sometimes you find multiple ways of doing one thing, and of course there's this massive sort of accidental complexity in managing a JavaScript project because of like all the deployment to different browsers and different language support levels and so on. I can really see there being value in that role. There's a tester. They do the testing. That's quite simple. They're not given the name QA because their job isn't to assure the quality of the product. It's the surgeon who takes ultimate responsibility for the quality of the product. What the tester does is to help design and implement test plans that that demonstrate that the quality attributes that the surgeon has come up with are correctly implemented. And then the language lawyer is the final role, and that role, that is somebody who takes knowledge in depth of the programming language and libraries and algorithms and things, and makes the best most efficient or the most sort of idiomatic use of the implementation details of the software system. And I've worked with people who would be brilliant as language lawyers, and there have been times when I have been that person or would have done well from having that role on the team. I remember one project I worked on, which was an Objective-C iPad application, where in order to get good enough performance out of the iPad 2 hardware, I had to implement an algorithm which I read the appropriate section in the Art of Computer Programming and some papers about the particular sort of data structure and its access algorithms, and then implemented them as an NS dictionary like Objective-C class, but using C++ for the implementation. And that's one of two examples I can think of where the project would have gone better. It had there been me or somebody else just taking that role of nerding out in depth on the language, on the tools, on the algorithms and data structures used, and not necessarily redesigning the thing, but re-implementing what we had to be more efficient and to make better use of the resources. But that leads us on to the question that I wanted to address, which is there are 10 roles in that programmer team. If we double count the secretaries, we don't know whether we would necessarily need or expect or want secretaries in a modern team. But the structure that Brooks talks about is very, very different from most software teams I come across these days, where there is a sort of more democratic seeming, though undemocratic in practice, structure. And the way that the sort of democracy or lack thereof tends to pan out is in terms of a sort of caste system. So I have worked in a number of places where I've met developers who consider themselves to be better than testers or QAs, and better than non-technical, using the scare quotes fingers, people. But then often also found that antagonism is reversed, and that the people who are actually selling the product, they believe that they have a better understanding of who the customers are and where the business should be going than the coders in their weird engineering cave. And so there's this sort of mutual or cyclic caste system. But often the developers don't have specialized roles. Everybody is responsible for just picking up tickets and working on user stories and everything. And there may be some sort of pecking order in terms of job title hierarchy in some places, or length of service in some other places. But there isn't really a sort of a DRI, a directly responsible individual system. Nobody has the, I'm going to make sure we're using the best libraries, or I'm going to make sure we're using the best tools, or I'm going to make all design decisions. There's a sort of flat structure. But would a targeted sort of surgical team structure with more specialization and with one person ultimately responsible for the decisions, would that make an interesting team dynamic? Would it work? I mean, we start by asking, would anybody actually want to work on such a team? We can all imagine that people would tend to gravitate towards that sort of surgical programmer role, and wouldn't necessarily want even the co-pilot role, or one of the more focused, like the toolsmith or the language lawyer, because they want to be able to make decisions. They want to be to have a seat at the decision-making table. Maybe a lot of programmers would not choose to work on such a team. But that doesn't necessarily answer the question, would it work? I mean, one of the things that Brooks is is doing in designing this team is ensuring that routes of communication are vastly simplified. That everybody talks to the senior programmer, to the surgeon, which makes it a role where interpersonal skills and people management skills are going to be much more important than any sort of programming capability. But otherwise, the people on the teams don't really have to sort of, communicate so much with so many other people. The administrator is responsible for the communications out with the rest of the organization. And you can imagine sort of guild systems where all of the toolsmiths from different teams come together, or all of the language lawyers, or all of the testers come together, and the surgeon takes technical questions out to other teams and also fields technical questions from other teams, or points people at the amazing documentation that the surgeon and the editor have created. But compare that to the amount of time on a standard flattish agile team that's taken up with communication. Both the sort of ceremonial communication, like the retrospectives, the planning meetings, the grooming meetings, the stand-ups, the huddles, the little task forces and what have you, and with the just the day-to-day making sure that everybody knows who's working on what, that doesn't really come out in the stand-up, because as we all know, they're a bit too formulaic. Yesterday I got nothing done, today I'm still going to be staring at this ticket and waiting for something else to happen, and I'm kind of blocked on that thing not happening, but I'm not going to mention that I'm blocked because I don't want people to see my weaknesses. So there's less communication necessary to get the job done, so perhaps more flow time. Decision making is centralized because there is no democracy on this team. The surgeon is ultimately responsible for all of the decisions, and they have a team of expert advisors to help them understand what decision would be best to make, but ultimately they make it. And imagine that we did have teams like that. What kind of career would they be? As we say, the sort of prestigious role we expect people to want to gravitate towards is the surgeon, and you could imagine that the co-pilot sort of role is a stepping stone to the surgeon role. But what about the routes between the other roles? If I'm, say, the editor, the responsible for the quality of the documentation, where do I go from there? Do I become a more sought after editor? Do I become the editor on a larger project? Can I really move from being the documentation quality person to, say, a testing role, or to a co-pilot role? Because it's a bit more sort of division of labour, because there are more specialisations, it's not clear that it's as flexible as using the scare quote fingers again, a full stack development position would be, which doesn't necessarily mean that it would be worse for any given team, but may mean that it's worse because people don't want those kinds of jobs, and therefore you'd have trouble hiring the small sharp team that Brooks needs for this to function well. There's plenty more to The Mythical Man Month. It was a really interesting book. It's from a long time ago. As I said before, the way in which we interact with computers is very different in that time. This episode is already much longer than I typically go for, so I'm actually not going to cover No Silver Bullet, which was the original motivation behind this episode, this time round. I'm going to do a separate episode on that. Thank you very much for listening. If you have any feedback, please send me an email, grahamlee@acm.org, or Twitter, iwasleeg, R-E-W-A-S-L-E-E-G. Thank you again, and I will talk to you soon.